Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And it is our first episode since Geek Way of the West, the board game convention in St. Louis that we go to every year. It was last week. We didn't put out an episode because it went on all weekend and we didn't get a chance to record anything, but we did get a chance to play a ton of very cool games.
Yeah, so we'll have a whole bunch of episodes in the near future going over those games, and many of which, if you look on our Twitter, you can actually see that I posted some screenshots on them. And this game that we're covering today is one of those that I posted on Twitter a screenshot of.
Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about The Quacks of Quedlinburg. Or is it Quedlinburg?
I think it's Quedlinburg.
Okay. Designed by Wolfgang Warsch and published in 2018 by Schmidt Spiel. And it won Kenner Spiel 2018, the Hobbyist Board Game of the Year award, and Golden Geek Best Family Game of 2018.
And you also told me a fun fact that the designer designed another game from last year that was very popular.
The Mind.
The Mind.
Which was also Spiel nominated, but for Spiel de Jahres, not Kenner Spiel. But really neat to think about that.
Yes. All right. So just to give a short description of Quacks of Quedlinburg. In Quacks of Quedlinburg, players are quack potion makers who brew potions and sell them at the market to get victory points and money, which they use to buy more ingredients for their potions. Each turn starts with players randomly drawing ingredients from their bags and placing them along a track. The higher the number on the track, the higher the number on the ingredient, the further down the track the ingredient goes. This continues until a player decides to stop drawing or when a player pushes their luck and their potion explodes, which is when their white ingredients total more than 7. When you end, or where you end on the track determines how much money and victory points your potion has earned, but if your potion exploded, you only get one of these rewards. You may also get bonus rewards based on the other kinds of ingredients in your potion, and after 9 rounds, the player with the most victory points wins. So that's a short description of how Quacks, or what Quacks of Quedlinburg is all about. So we're going to get into the gameplay portion of our episode now. We're going to talk a little bit more in detail about how the game is played, and we're going to go over the strategies in the game. So
big caveat.
Oh, okay.
So the game has like basic and advanced rule sets, and we only have played with the basic set of rules.
Are you referencing the ingredient books, Matthew?
Yes.
Okay, so I've kind of accounted for that in my notes, and that I've tried to take more general notes about some of the mechanics in this game. There's probably some new stuff that I can't account for because we didn't play it. But yeah, so the game has these ingredient components. They're these small cardboard discs with various colors, and they have numbers on them that go from 1 to 4, and they go in your bag and you pull them out. And then the game also has these ingredient books. Now, your white ingredient, your orange ingredient, and to an extent, your black ingredients in the game are all going to have the same effect every time you play. But there's also yellow, blue, red, green, and purple ingredients that will have a different effect every time you play based on what ingredient booklet you put out on the table. And these ingredient booklets, they just tell you what each of those ingredients does in this gameplay session.
Yeah.
And the game suggests one ingredient set or ingredient rule set for your first time playing the game, and that is what we used, and we only play the game one time. So that is what we're going off of here.
Yeah.
So if we reference specific abilities, then you know we're referencing the first set of rules. But I mean it's gonna be the one you play by the first time you play it. So some of it will help. But for the most part, I'm going to try to just stick to more like general mechanical ideas in this portion. Okay, but let's get a little more in detail about how the game is played. So it's played over 9 rounds. For 8 of those 9 rounds, every round except the last one, players can draw from their bags and start to build out their potions at their own pace all at the same time. It's just kind of like you just go until you want to stop, and then you stop, and you don't have to wait on anybody else. I mean, I guess you have to wait on the last person to finish their potion before you can start the rest of the turn, but you don't have to wait on anybody else while you're building your potion. You just do it at your own pace.
Right.
So that means you're reaching into your bag, you're pulling out a random ingredient, and you're adding it to your tracker. So your tracker, you have a disc on your tracker that's called your drip, and that is where you start on the tracker. It starts, this is like a spiral that you're working on. You start in the center and spiral outwards. So the drip will always start in the very center on the very first spot. And then every time you pull out an ingredient, whatever number is on that ingredient, you'll count forward that many spaces on the tracker and put the ingredient there. So if it's one, then your ingredient is going to go on the next space. If it's two, then it's going to go two spaces away from the last thing on the tracker. If it's three and four and so on.
Yeah.
Where you stop building your potion, the next space after that last piece that you've placed on your potion tracker is the one that you're looking at to figure out what kind of rewards you're going to get. So there's going to be a number of different symbols on that next space that will show you your rewards. There's going to be a little brown square with a number on it, and that'll be how many victory points that space will give you. There's going to be the space itself is like a bubble, like a greenish bubble.
Almost looks like ice cream.
Yeah, that'll tell you how much currency you can spend. I'm not exactly sure what the currency is in this game because it's almost...
I think it's money because you just sell the potion as the flavor.
Right. But I mean, they don't have any like money depicted in the game. Yeah. It's always just these bubbles.
Right. Yeah.
But anyways, whatever's on the bubble, that's how much money you get to buy more ingredients. And then sometimes there might be a little ruby icon, a little gem icon on the space. And if there is, then you get to collect a gem, which is kind of like a premium currency that you use for certain things in this game, but not for acquiring ingredients.
Right.
So, so you build your potion. You go until you stop, and the two cases in which you stop is when you decide to stop because you just don't want to keep going personally, or you bust, as in a press your luck game, which in this game means your potion explodes. So let's talk about what you start with in your bag.
So you start with four white chips that move one space, so four white ones, and then two white twos and a white three. And then a green one and an orange one.
So the majority of the pieces in your bag are white pieces. And these are important because these will determine whether or not your potion explodes. So as you're building your potion, you need to be adding up what your white pieces total to. Because once that number reaches more than seven, that means that your potion explodes.
Yeah.
So when you're approaching seven is when you want to be very careful and you want to weigh your options in this game. You have two twos and a three and four ones. So just from that composition, at any given point, you will know how many white pieces are left in your bag and what their numbers are and how likely you are to explode if you were to draw the wrong number.
Right.
Usually that just means you go until you get to seven or sometimes six if all you have left is twos and threes in your bag. And then you just probably stop there unless you're hurting for resources because exploding in this game is pretty detrimental.
Sort of. I mean, it's as bad. Let's get into what it does at least.
Right. Well, it's not as bad as like losing your whole turn.
Right.
So after everyone has decided to stop drawing resources, then there's sort of a order of operations for the rest of the turn. In how your abilities activate and how you can spend your resources. So first thing that happens is the person that got the furthest along on their track gets to roll a die to get a small bonus resource. And I believe that'll either move your drip or give you a gem. There might be a couple other small things, but they're usually just a very small bonus to your pot. Then afterwards, there's three resources that will trigger at this point. There's the black resource, the green resource, and the purple resource will trigger after you roll the die to give you some amount of gems or possibly move your drip, at least in the base game. In more advanced versions of the games, they still activate at this point, but we're not sure exactly what they do at this point. Probably something similar. They'll give you probably some gems and move your drip or do something else. The third thing is you get the gem that is on the next space. If there is one. And then the fourth and fifth things are where it matters whether or not you exploded. And that is you gain the victory points and you gain the money. So right. If you exploded, you only get one of those two.
Either or.
And if you didn't, you get both.
Right. And then after every player gets money or doesn't get money in case they explode and choose points, players can then buy the ingredients on the table. And mm-hmm. each ingredient has a cost in money for its one, two, or three, depending on however many it, you know, lets you buy. So most ingredients will have a 1, 2, and 4 increment, and when we played, the black and the orange did not.
Right.
But the fours, of course, cost much more. The ones cost the least. But you can only buy at most two ingredients of any type, and you cannot buy two of the same ingredient type.
Right. So just to go over an example, in the game we played, the red ingredient, the red one cost 6, the red two cost 10. And the red 4 cost 16.
Right.
That's kind of how the prices will change.
Right. And then you do this in turn order, I believe.
You do, but I don't think it makes much of a difference.
Right.
I guess there is scarcity of resources, but there are a lot of resources, and you don't buy resources so often that one will run out, unless everybody's only buying one type of resource.
Right. I was going to say, when we played, there was one resource type, that being black, which interacted with other players, because mm-hmm. it only had effects if you had the most black resources in play out of your neighbors. Mm-hmm. So technically, being further along in somebody informs that decision.
Sure.
But that's about it.
Now, after certain rounds of the game, components are added. So I believe after round two, at the start of round two, the yellow ingredient is added to the game. At the start of the game, you only have access to the orange, red, green, blue, and black resources, or black ingredients. So at the beginning of round two, we add a yellow ingredient. And at the beginning of round three, we add the purple ingredient. And then at the beginning of round six, we add an extra white ingredient to our player bags.
Right. So it does get a little bit harder to get non-white stuff in the late game.
Right.
Just a tiny bit.
Just a tiny bit. Let's see. Is there anything else gameplay-wise that we need to talk about?
I guess we need to talk about the flask and the rubies.
Okay. So every player has a flask. It starts activated. And after you use it, it becomes deactivated. When you use it, what it lets you do is it lets you take the last piece that you drew, as if it were a white piece, it lets you take the last piece you drew, the last ingredient you drew, and put it back in your bag, as if you never drew it.
Right.
So this is good at the beginning of a round. If you draw your white 3 ingredient very early on, or even maybe one of your white 2 ingredients, you could just put it back in the bag. You get a free redo. Now, there's a rule that you cannot use this ability if that white ingredient that you just drew would cause your potion to explode. You can't use it to avoid an explosion.
Yeah.
You can only use it in the middle of your turn or at the beginning of your turn to give yourself a better chance for that turn. Now, right. After you use it, it becomes deactive. And in order to reactivate it, you have to spend those gems that I mentioned earlier.
Right.
So it takes 2 gems to reactivate your flask. But you could also spend those 2 gems to push your drip forward 1 space, which means that you will start the next round of potion crafting 1 space ahead of the previous round.
Right. And all future rounds.
And all future rounds. Yes, it's a permanent change.
Right. Now, that's not the only thing that can change where you start at the round.
Uh-huh.
At the start of every new round, so on the point tracker, you look at where the furthest ahead person is and where the furthest behind person is.
And there is a point tracker component to this game that goes around the edge of this central board.
Right. And on this point tracker, there are these rats whose rat tails will be making lines between some of the spaces on the point tracker.
Every two or three spaces, there is a rat. And they're like you said, their tail goes through between two other spaces. And so at the beginning of a round, you look at who's in front and who's in behind and who's in last, who's in first and last, and you count the number of rat tails in between their pieces. And everyone who's not in first gets to move a rat tail marker that number of spaces along the tracker before they start making potions. And right. That is where you will start.
You move it ahead of your drip that many right. spaces.
Exactly.
Right. So it's sort of a catch-up mechanic.
So whoever's not in first gets a little head start in any given round.
Right, yeah.
All right, so let's talk about strategy in this game.
Okay.
It goes without saying that I think that potions exploding is a very bad thing. You said it's not so bad.
So I think there is a window where it's a bad thing. However, okay. in like the first two rounds, maybe even three, I think it's okay to try to go for an explosion because you still get your ingredient on there, however many spaces it would be. Which means that if you need the money early game, then maybe getting the explosion is okay.
That is a good point. That so, when you do explode, you do at least get to place the piece that you exploded from. You're not out of luck there.
Right. Up until...
You can go ahead.
I was going to say around 15 money is where the pot, the like track you move your stuff on, starts to lower the amount of money you get per increment or per space. Mm-hmm. So like if you need to get like a couple good pieces or ingredients early on, then it might be okay to explode and get that, because then also like at least you'll be getting a rat tail.
Right. So just to kind of be a little more specific, so you said around 15 money, essentially the 15th space, up until the 15th space on the board, or on your player board, on your tracker, your bubble tracker, up until the 15th space, every space is going up by one money.
Yeah.
Up until then, after 15, it starts going every other space, it'll increase. So there's two 15s, two 16s, two 17s, and so on until the end of the board. And the points that you earn also go at a decreased rate. They're the opposite. They go at a decreased rate at the start of the spiral, and they increase in rate towards the end. So the first 9 or 10 spaces, they only give you 1 point, no matter how high you are. Up to 10, I think, is where you only get 1 point. I believe it stops at 9. 10, 11, 12, 13. You get 2 points. 14, 15, 16, 17. Sorry. 14, 15, 15, 16. Duh. Because it starts to slow down there. You get 3. It goes every 4 up until you get to
6,
7 points. Yeah, 6 points is the last. Right. Up to 6 points, which is, I don't know, the 30th spot at this point.
Yeah.
So yeah, early in the game, pushing your luck to explode won't give you too big a detriment of points that you're earning, and it will give you a good bonus in money.
Right.
So, I guess, yes, in the first two or three turns, right. It's okay to explode.
And I was also going to say, in maybe the last round, it's okay to explode if you are near the next point increment.
Right, because in the last round, you only are going for points. The money doesn't matter at this point.
Yeah, at this point.
even the second
to last round.
That makes sense. But in the middle of the game, you don't want to be exploding because right. you need to be getting both money so that you can increase the overall quality of ingredients in your bag, as well as the points, because you got to start keeping up in points with everybody else.
Right.
But just a 1 to 2 point difference at the beginning of the game won't make a big difference at the end of the game.
Yeah.
But the money might, because again, you get to buy two ingredients every turn. They have to be different ingredients. But they can get kind of expensive. So the difference between 10 and 11 is the difference between buying a good ingredient and a poor ingredient versus two good ingredients.
Right. And then once you start getting into being able to afford a tier 2 and a tier 1 ingredient, then, you know, every increment of money counts.
Tier two and tier three. I would say a two value ingredient and a four value ingredient.
Well, sure. Yeah.
Oh, you mean a tier two plus a tier one.
Yes.
And you're buying. Okay. I get now.
Yeah.
I get it now.
And this is specifically, so if you only buy tier one ingredients throughout the whole game, you're not ever going to be able to get to, I think, even the 12 point spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you'll have 16 spaces worth of ingredients you're getting. So you want to be able to get those tier twos and eventually the four space ingredients pretty quickly.
Right. Now, this is an important piece of strategy that I didn't take into account when we played. And that is that the tier one ingredients fall off a cliff in how useful they are.
Yeah.
The one space ingredients, because like we mentioned when we were describing the tracker, after 15, it's every other space will give you an increase in points. And that means that a single tier one ingredient half the time will not change your reward for a round.
Whereas a single tier two will change your points by one increment.
Exactly. A single tier two is guaranteed to change your points. A single tier four or four space ingredient is guaranteed to change your points you're getting twice, because it's two twos. Now also towards the end of the tracker and towards the end of the game, you're getting into the spaces where every three spaces your victory point value will increase, and so fours are especially valuable there because now they are guaranteed to increase the amount of victory points you're going to get by one.
Exactly.
So basically, I would say as soon as you are consistently getting more than 15 points in a round, you need to stop buying tier one ingredients. Not altogether, but right. You need to be prioritizing the two space and the four space ingredients at this point.
Right. Like if you can buy like that orange that costs three and you can get like a two or a four, that's still pretty good compared to just buying two tier ones.
Right. Yeah, even if the tier ones have a good ability, getting a single bad tier two is better than getting two good tier ones, in my opinion.
Yeah,
and getting a single bad tier four, we keep calling them tier fours, but it's not really tiers. But getting a single four space piece is better than getting two very powerful one space pieces, or even maybe a powerful two space and a powerful one space.
From the basic versions we played with of each of the ingredients, I don't think there were any really bad ones per se.
Well, I mean the red piece didn't have any bonus effects.
Well, it did.
And the bonus effect wasn't like super tangible, I guess.
I think that's just because we weren't playing for it. So
the orange one definitely has no effect.
Well, just to give some context, in the like basic version of the red piece, it says when you play it, you move it ahead one space for every orange piece you have in play.
That's not exactly accurate.
Really?
It's if you have one or two orange pieces already in your potion, it moves forward an extra space. And if you have three or more orange pieces already in your pot, it moves forward an extra two spaces.
Right, my bad.
I
was gonna say
it doesn't give you like a gem benefit. It doesn't put your white pieces back. It doesn't draw filter. It doesn't move your drip.
It's pure movement for that turn, though.
Right. It might be good just because I guess red has technically the best one.
Right. I think
one cost.
I think my thing was just that we didn't really play around it. So I think from the one game we had, we didn't have enough of a sample size.
But I mean, taking into account the rules that we've kind of established now, the rules of thumb that like twos and fours are very good compared to ones, that in order to have successful reds, you need to have a lot of orange ones, and oranges only come in ones.
Well, let me put it like this then, that if you can get like a two or a four and an orange one, that's pretty good because then late game you can get all these red fours and they'll have big payoffs. So reds turn your oranges that you get from filler into payoff.
That's true, but I think when we played, we were getting enough money that we didn't have to keep buying like X and an orange.
Right.
Like we were constantly buying stuff other than orange in twos, you know?
Right. I think
I will also say that in the game we played, hold on, actually I need to confirm this in a different image because I'm looking at the wrong blue set.
Oh. I was going to say, I think personally, it's just something where I want to play the game again and try a different strategy.
Okay. So I found what I was looking for. In the version that we played, the blue pieces, the one was cost less than a red one, and the blue two cost the same amount as the red two. And I think the blue is way better than the red pieces.
Right. In the version we did. Yeah. In the version we did, the blues would let you look at however many pieces from your bag as the number on the blue and play one of them or put them all back in your bag. So it was more consistency. But anyways, yeah, let's move away from the specifics.
Let's take a step back from this discussion and let's talk more about the mechanics that the ingredients can possibly have just in a general sense.
Right.
And which ones are best for getting high numbers on your player board. So I have a couple mechanics listed here, and these are mechanics that we found in our game, but they probably exist in some form in the more advanced games. And one of them is draw filtering.
Mm-hmm.
And this is specifically what the blue pieces did in our game. If I was a betting man, I would bet that there is draw filtering in other sets of rules. But essentially the ability to have some sort of control over what you are going to draw next can be very strong in this game.
It's also no risk. It's a draw with zero risk, which is really important in a press your luck game.
Exactly. The second mechanic that I have here that probably exists in other rule sets, but definitely was in ours, is counters to the white pieces. So stuff that interacts with your own white pieces in your tracker. In the game we played, this were the yellow pieces. Their effect was that if there was a white piece that was played before them, you return it to your bag.
Right. And this kind of has some weird interactions with just like the chances you're going to draw a white piece. I think the way I put it is even though it adds another white piece to your bag, it removed the one you just put in. So like even if it gets rid of a one, that means that your chance of drawing a one white is slightly higher, which is the safest white piece.
Right. I would also say that it's just like drawing a white piece is an unlucky draw. You could just say that like of the chances to draw a piece out of your bag, the piece you want to draw the least of is a white piece. So of that random chance, you got the unfavorable result. And putting a white piece back into your bag, sure, it slightly increases the chances of that unfavorable result happening, but it now gives you more chances to avoid that unfavorable result.
Right.
It kind of like takes a check mark away from like a death save in Dungeons and Dragons or something like that.
Right. While it makes your bag worse, it makes your board better.
Yeah.
Which is what's important during the drawing.
Yeah.
I think the third effect that is pretty good to have at least a few of is extra rubies.
Mm-hmm.
There were a bunch of these that did this effect in our game that we played. But basically, like, if you can move the drip up one space every round, then it... I mean, like, so if you think about, like, you're moving seven spaces with the white pieces. If the drip starts at zero, then you'll get seven coins in 1 point. But, like, if it starts at three, you'll get 10 coins in 2 points. Or if it starts at two, you get 9 points or 9 coins a point in a ruby. So being able to move that drip pretty quickly does have big impact early on.
Right. Or, so there's effects that give you rubies. There's also effects that just straight up move your drip.
Right. Or late game, having rubies means you can refill your flask every turn, which means that you're able to use that flask more often to go for riskier plays.
Right. The flask is basically counterplay against your white pieces. So this is a lot like that second mechanic we talked about. And yes, it's very, very useful to have just an extra gimme on any given turn. Now, and I will also add that moving your drip forward the first 15 spaces is very valuable, because like we said, those first 15 is an increase in one. So, you know, every drip movement for the first 15 drip movements is worth one extra dollar, if you kind of think of it that way.
Right. Yeah.
And then, I mean, after I guess that's at the beginning of the game. At the end of the game, you want to move it forward two spaces at a given time. So that means because you're trying to get past those pairs of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So forget what I just said and take this into account, that if you have both Ruby acquisition and drip movement, then you can possibly move your drip forward twice in a given turn.
Yeah.
And that's very good.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like in general, the early game, like the first half of the game, you want to start by getting money and resources and then pivot to points. And mm-hmm. then late game, you want to focus your efforts into getting points mostly.
Yeah.
And
it's also very good to move your drip early in the game, just because that's value that you will bank on every turn for the rest of the game.
Right. Yeah. It's sort of universally good. It's almost like buying a one piece and always having it in play with no risk.
Right. Right. So I guess in general, in short, I think what we've kind of said is that the two and the four space ingredients are very powerful in this game. They're better than most of the one space ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And then mechanic wise, draw filtering, counteraction against your white pieces, and drip movement and gem acquisition are all very good.
Right.
How would you rate them against one another? Do you think draw filtering is probably the best, followed by maybe gems?
Yeah, I think that's a safe thing to look at it.
Mm-hmm. And it might depend on the stage of the game too.
Yeah.
Maybe the white counteraction's a little better at the end of the game, but gems are versatile.
Yeah.
And they can be white counteraction at the end of the game. Like
exactly.
Flask. So maybe it goes like filtering, then gems.
Exactly.
Cool.
All right.
So shall we talk about how it was designed?
Yes.
Or is there anything else you could say strategy-wise?
No, I'm good.
Okay, let's get into the design discussion.
Yes.
So it's a press your luck game.
Mm-hmm.
First thing I want to say is that the draw bag is a very flavorful component in this game.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, it's a push your luck game. Lots of other push your luck games will use a deck of cards, or they will use
dice.
First of all, dice as a push your luck mechanic are hard to predict, or, you know, sometimes, I mean, they're dice. There's no prediction when it comes to dice.
Yeah.
Except by just knowing what the faces are. But as a deck of cards, you can at least know like what's left in your deck. And in a bag's case, you know what's left in your bag.
Right.
But so the difference between a bag and a deck then is that the bag adds some kind of immersion in this game, for one.
Oh,
yeah. Because, you know, you're drawing ingredients out of a pouch. An ingredients pouch is like a fantasy trope of sorts. But also... it adds this activity to the game that you wouldn't get from a deck of cards. This like picking up a sack full of things and shaking it around and reaching in and pulling something out. That whole experience is very unique to this game.
Right. It's like you're acting out the role of this quack brewing a potion in a market square.
Yeah. You do actually look kind of insane when you do it.
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah.
I love it.
Now, okay, go ahead.
I was also going to say the bag makes it harder to visualize the quantity of ingredients, which makes it seem a bit more mysterious. Because, like, a deck of cards, if it's low on cards, like, that's very visual. But with a bag, like, even when you're low on, you know, however many chips there are and you can kind of feel it, it still feels like this dark and strange object that you're pulling from, which is fitting for... this like voodoo potion.
I'll also say that the bag added like a little bit of paranoia to the gameplay, because with a deck, you know, you shuffle it and then you set it down, and like that's all the influence that you have over the deck. Now it's just going to be in that order, and there's nothing you can do about it. So drawing the card, there's like very little there's less tension to it. Like, there's still the chance that you bust, but if the card on top is the card that makes you bust, you know, whatever. That's because the deck was shuffled that way. There's nothing you could have done. But with the bag, like, every time you pull a piece out of the bag, it's like it's your fault that you pulled that piece out.
Yeah. And
so I constantly found myself second guessing. Like, I would hold a piece in my fingers and I'd be like, no, this can't be it. And I'd drop it and I'd fish around for a different, even though I couldn't see what I was pulling.
Right. And it invites superstition too.
Yeah.
And like, I think that's part of the fun thing is, like, flavorfully, there isn't really any indication that these potions do anything. Like, there's no magic abilities or anything, even though the ingredients look magic. Like, there's a mandrake root and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's like a root with a face on it.
You don't really see the effects of it. They just might explode. And having the player invite that superstition that might not be real just kind of adds to that.
Yeah, I was even like, I was convincing myself that all the good pieces were stuck at the bottom of my bag or something. And I just wasn't fishing for them because I had some very unlucky turns.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Now, there's a mark against at least the base game. And that is that the tiny cardboard pieces do not elegantly jumble around in a bag. This is partly due to my superstition, but actual functionality, like the way that the bag is made, it's like a square pouch. And so the corners can kind of fold over at the bottom of the bag and they can kind of capture some of your pieces.
Right. There's a seam at the bottom that things can get kind of stuck between.
Right. If you're just kind of holding your bag loosely and fishing around in it, some pieces can get trapped in the corners of the bag and not get jumbled up with the rest of your pieces.
And the bag is like a typical cloth dice bag, but that makes it hard for the pieces to slide around just based on friction alone.
Right.
So there is that.
There's also the fact that, like, after a full game, like, if you're actually really trying to jumble up the pieces every time you pull out of the bag, your arms can get kind of tired.
Oh, yeah.
At least that's what I experienced. But otherwise, I think it's a very exciting mechanic. It's a very fun component to this game. I think they make a premium version. At least I've seen pictures of a premium version that uses wooden pieces for the ingredients instead of the cardboard punch-out pieces. And I can imagine those would be much more elegant, much easier to manipulate than these tiny flimsy. They're not flimsy, but these just tiny little cardboard chits.
Yeah. I want to talk about how this game sort of reinterprets a Press Your Luck game.
Okay.
So Press Your Luck games are often about the luck and there's little to no mitigation in a lot of them. So, like, the decision of pressing your luck is usually just a question of odds. But this game, by having, like, this economic resource element, it does give you more of a strategy around that. And, like, we even mentioned how, like, sometimes it's good to explode or, you know, it's worth pressing your luck because of that. That's, like, a really different approach to the concept of press your luck that, for one thing, lowers the tension of decision makings early on. Because, like, you can kind of see that the points aren't worth it compared to the money. So early in the game, you know, a new player might be more willing to press their luck because of that, or they won't feel as punished by doing so.
Right. I mean, honestly, it's you also look at, like, the action board in the center of the table that shows, like, the order of operations, and of the six actions that they have these little flags that and each flag has an icon that shows you what you do for each of those actions. Of the six, only two of them are affected by exploding. You still get the benefits of the other four. I mean, you get five of those six actions.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So exploding is really, like, not a huge deal. It's a press your luck game, but the downside of pressing your luck is minimal in this game compared to other press your luck games.
Right. And it's interesting. So the main reason why you might want to pivot early in the game strategy wise is if other players are ahead of points than you, or you could play riskier if you're ahead of points, but you want to build economy, which means that for a good portion of the game, a lot of the decision making of press your luck is influenced by other players. You know, I've heard games like Dungeon Roll, which is another press your luck game that we like. I've heard the main criticism that it doesn't have any player interaction. It's just player versus player, points versus points. But because of everybody getting points simultaneously, but also building up these resources, it's a lot more manifold.
Mm-hmm.
In that sort of decision, there's like a bit more player interaction.
Well, that's interesting though, because there's really not a lot of player interaction in this game.
Sure.
Like even in the game that we played, there was one piece of pseudo player interaction, and that was the black ingredient that said if you have more black ingredients in your potion than your neighbors, then you get bonuses. Right. But that doesn't actually interact with that checks what they have, but sure, they aren't affected by it.
I guess what I should say is the decision to press your luck because of points is a bit different in this game than other games because sure, of the whole economic aspect.
Sure.
Yeah. Also, the deal with the explosion in like sorry, let me take a step back. So when you are adding ingredients to your bag, it means that you have more control over the odds than what other games might allow. But also, since you're the one putting them in your bag, you have like a much more intimate knowledge of the chances you'll draw a given thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even though we mentioned the whole superstition and like, you know, you can't be really sure. But like, you know, if you add four, you know, one pieces of non-white colors, then like, you know that there's that many pieces that you can draw. So like it gives you a lot more control, but it also means that you feel more in power over mm-hmm. it. This game has a lot of good catch-up mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Now like, it has catch-up mechanics, but it also has like rewards for being in first.
Yeah. Cause there's that die that you roll.
Right, but, and that die goes to whoever has the piece that is furthest along on the tracker.
Right, though it should be noted that also can be done by the person who has all the rat tails. So, like, the rat tails, which are one of the main catch-up mechanics, can help swing and change who has which bonus.
Right, good point.
Mm-hmm. And, like, even just by having points and then economy, it gives you multiple ways to play, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if somebody is beating you in economy, you can go for points and force them to go for points so you can catch up in economy, that sort of thing.
I want to mention that there's very little player downtime in this game,
mm-hmm.
which is a good thing. You're not sitting around waiting for people to finish their turns for most of this game. Because the drawing and of your from your bag and the making your potion, the press your luck element, everyone does that at the same time. And then all the steps, the actions that you take after you're finished with your potions, they all just happen at the same time for each player until you get to buying. So there's only one thing in the game that goes in turn order, and you have to wait for the person before you to finish their turn. Everything else is at the same time, even when you get to the ninth round, in which case people are drawing from their bags at the same time. There's very little waiting in that portion as well. Like, people will duck out early or explode early in that portion and we'll have to wait for everyone else to finish. But there's not a lot of time there either. So you're constantly involved in the game, which is right. Nice.
I like the mechanic of like having the rubies on the board, where like certain spaces will give you rubies, because it does make the decision to press your luck or stay a bit less binary.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it gives you maybe a reason to consider stopping early because you're on a point with a ruby and you're not sure if gaining the extra victory points or money would be worth it compared to that. Mm-hmm. And I think the rubies are very appropriately powerful for that to take effect.
So the last few points that I have to make are about more about the components.
Oh,
so if you have any more mechanical.
I do.
Okay.
So this is based on the basic versions of the ingredients we did. which is that, for one thing, with the basic ingredients, since technically buying any two of an ingredient is equal to or cheaper than buying only one tier two, then it kind of encourages players in round one who are new to the game to buy two ingredients and encourages them to mess around with multiple effects quicker.
Mm-hmm.
Which this is like just related to the new player experience, you know, so you know, encouraging players to experiment with your mechanics is pretty good. But then also, each of the resources that we interacted with, the ingredients and how they worked, a lot of them either got better in higher quantities or had some sort of positioning element to them, to the point where each ingredient did add multiple decisions to the press your luck decision, if that makes sense. Like for yellows, it's like, do I want to press my luck now if I have like six white total because the yellow could get rid of the one I just played? Or for green, it's like, you know, do I want to play any more or keep going, or do I want to keep my green where it is and get an extra ruby? So like the resources or the ingredients you buy ramp up the complexity in that decision making, but mm-hmm. at a very natural way that the player controls. And that's good for that first play. And I like mm-hmm. games in general that have like modal complexity, I should say, where like you can play a simpler mode that gets the gist across or a more complicated mode with slightly different interactions or mix and match.
Right.
All right. So yeah,
that's a pretty good segue into my first point in the components
mm-hmm.
That I wanted to make now. And that is that this game does something very cool that I don't see like many other games doing. And that is that they have these components that are sort of like blank slates. And then they have accompanying components that define what they do, that define like their mechanics. And that is in the ingredient books and the ingredients themselves. So like we said, there's these set of books. They're these book-shaped cardboard tiles, and they have the rules for what each ingredient does. So the blue ingredient will do this because you have this blue book out. And there's four different blue books that can each change what the mechanics of the blue ingredient are in a given game. So this is a very smart way of just not having to have tons and tons of components in your game that you mix and match to create different setups at the beginning of the game, different like pools that you draw from at the beginning of the game. It's elegant. If you can compare it to something like Dominion, which aims to have a similar experience in replays where you have a different pool of options to draw from every game, and that'll inform the decisions that you make at all stages of the game. And your strategy going into it. But it does so without having to have a different deck of cards for every different effect that they want to have in the game.
Right. And also it saves on table space. Mm-hmm. Like one problem with things like cards or tiles that have a lot of words is that you can't really have a lot of words on them. It limits either the scale or scope of the effect or the size of the component. And this has really small components to have a big player board relative to the components without needing a huge, huge amount of space.
I mean, even just rather than having like a small icon depiction on the component itself to tell you what that component does, they just need to have enough space for the number plus a little illustration to give it some aesthetic, some flavor. They just need enough space for that one number, and then they can put all the rules text for those components on those books that just sit in the middle of the table.
Though this also works. Oh, I was going to say this also works because the ingredients, there's only like 7 or 8 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they are easily recognizable by color and image. So like there's really easy to connect like the rule to the piece at a glance. Yeah,
they're distinct.
And you look at the books, multiple times throughout a turn even. So it's really quick to, match these and memorize what each of them do.
Now, I could see how it would be annoying to have to constantly go to these books in the middle of the table to check what the thing you just drew did. And that did become somewhat of an issue when we played, especially when it came to the purple pieces, because they have pretty different effects depending on how many purple pieces you've played. I guess, although you didn't really have to reference them until that one part during the action phases after we're done making potions. But even still, I think with this game, they have struck sort of a balance that, like, the amount of times that I have to go back and check what a book does is not bothersome. Yeah. With the way it is now. There's seven different types of resources in any given game. And so having to reference those seven things. Plus, I mean, they also mitigate this in a way because you only start with four of them out on the table at the start of the game.
Right.
Like, you don't even get a chance to read the others, I guess, technically. You probably should if you want to play the game just to know what's coming up. But you don't have to pay attention to those kinds of things until later
in the game. Yeah, you can kind of compartmentalize them.
Which can be pretty nice. I guess also the ingredients are kept in piles next to their books. So you're never looking too far to get some context on when something does.
Yeah.
The last thing that I want to talk about is that this game very successfully uses a thing called skeuomorphism. Matthew, do you know what skeuomorphism is?
No, but I can guess, but you should just say it.
Okay, maybe probably a bunch of graphic designers are rolling their eyes at this because this gets used a lot in graphic design. But skeuomorphism is essentially designing something so that it looks like a physical version of what it is, even though it's not a physical version of that. So an example is like an app on a phone. They might put a dial for turning up the volume like you would have in your car radio. But it's not a real dial. It's a flat image that you swipe around in a circle to manipulate.
Okay.
And this game does that with a bunch of its components to great success. And a lot of games don't do this. So like the ingredient books, they look like books. They look like they're flat pieces of cardboard, but they look like 3D books. The player board looks like a workstation on a table. It looks kind of cleverly 3D to the point where when you're flat, they have like a little dish that your flask rests on. And when you have it set up there, it's kind of surprising.
Oh yeah. Whoever illustrated the flask, that's like fantastic force perspective sort of thing.
Yeah. It sits on this disc, like the curvature of the disc with the curvature of the flask, how it overlaps that. And it also overlaps a little of your mixing pot, you know, as it would if it were 3D sitting in front of it. You know, it's very brilliant.
Yeah.
Not only that, but the workstation that you have as your player board that you mix your potion on is a workstation that would be placed on a table in front of you if you were an actual potion brewer. So you're sitting at the table and you're working on this workstation that would be on a table. You know, it's this level of immersion that benefits from the skeuomorphism.
Right. Or you have a pouch of rubies that you put your rubies you gain on top of. And it, when you put them all together, it does kind of look like it's just a giant pile of gems.
Just to clarify, it's an illustration of a pouch of
right,
rubies.
Right, yeah, my
that's
bad.
On your player board.
Yeah.
So all this, so what does all this do? Well, I mean, it adds a level of immersion, of aesthetic to this game, a very high level of it that a lot of other games don't have. Like, compare it to a player board in another game that just has rectangular spaces for your stuff. You know, mm-hmm. There's just, this is the rectangle where you keep your dice, this is the rectangle where you put your cards, this is the rectangle where you put your other cards. Compare that to this is the dish where you set your flask, this is the bowl where you keep your rat tails, this is the pouch where you keep your gems, and this is the pot, the bubbling pot where you mix your ingredients.
This is the tome you reference for the rules.
It's super well done, and it's a little exciting to mm-hmm. to see it the first time. It left a big impression on me when saw it for the first time.
It also yeah, it also makes it so that, like, if you see somebody playing this game, it makes it more appealing to play. Mm-hmm. This is something that I've seen with a couple games, is that, like, just looking at, like, at a convention, just people playing this game, like, it's something that makes you want to stop and see what it is.
Right.
I know a few people stopped to look at what we were doing.
You're not just looking at a bunch of rectangles and hexagons sitting on a table.
It's these big jutting out cauldrons.
Yeah. So so that's the last point that I wanted to make about this game.
Also,
it just looks pretty cool.
Illustration-wise, the books that the ingredients are on have like these little like illustrations that you'd see in like an alchemy journal.
Yeah, they look like notebooks. They have like they have the ingredient prominently featured, fully colored, but then there's also these like these sketches
and
around
charts.
The ingredient and charts and notes.
Yeah, it's very like kind of scribbled in. Like Michelangelo or like Da Vinci. Voynich manuscript.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really neat. Just these tiny little details. I had a lot of fun just looking at the details in the ingredient books.
Right. Now, I think that too much of this kind of thing can look tacky, but I think, I don't know, in this game, it just doesn't come off as tacky. It just always looks pretty cool.
It's also that they're in, like, very light pencil, so they're very easy to kind of mentally block out. Like, if you focus on the colored part, then you won't really notice them.
No, I'm talking about, like, everything in this game.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Can look tacky. Like, skeuomorphism, this kind of representation can look pretty tacky in other games. I think maybe it's just that this game commits to it, like, 100% in the ingredient books, in the player board. It's 100% skeuomorphic. It's 100% illustrations that look like objects that are sitting in front of you. You can compare it to like a playing card from a game that might have like an illustration. It might have like a little piece of paper that the effect is written inside of. It's like when you start combining these treatments with more abstract things, then they just kind of become glaring.
Right. It goes from a gimmick to an identity.
Yeah.
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 Right.
So it looks very cool. And that is all that I have to say about Quacks of Kedlinburg.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything else, Matthew?
I was just going to say a game that I would recommend that's similar to this, that being Dice Forge, which is another resource building press your luck hybrid that we did an episode on.
Right. Less so press your luck, but still a lot about like random chances and manipulating your chances.
Right.
All right. And then that, I guess, will be the end of our episode on Quacks of Kedlinburg. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. Oh, also Flip City.
Flip City. Oh, Flip City is a great press your luck game. Yeah. So if you liked our episode, you can follow us on social media and let us know if you have requests for other games. You can find us on social media and hit us up. Our social media is on Facebook and Twitter, BG Bros Cast. Find us there. You could also go to our website, bgbcast.com, if you're looking for more episodes. We have all of our episodes tagged, so if you want to find that Dice Forge episode or any other episode of a game that you're interested in, you could go to our website, bgbros.com. bgbcast.com.
There you go.
And yes, bgbcast.com, and look through those tags for our website. You can also find a link to our TeePublic store on our website. You can go to there at teepublic.com/user/bgbcast, which is where we sell our merch. We have t-shirts with our logo. They're very, very cool looking. They come in a variety of colors. You can pick those up there. And that will do it for our end of the episode plugs for the cast. So let's hear some Matt plugs.
I stream at twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/twak. I stream most weekdays from 11 a.m. Central Time to about 2 or 3 p.m. Central Time. I stream a lot of competitive games, fighting games, roguelites, card games, you name it. Lately, I've also been getting back into speedrunning a game called Hob, so that's pretty cool. And you can also find a Discord server through that Twitch channel where you can talk to us on there and get alerted to when I stream as well. And also, I write articles for the BGBcast website under the Episodes and Articles tab. My most recent article, I believe, was the one about flavorful gameplay on Enter the Gungeon. And the next article is taking a bit longer than I thought it would. I've been writing up a couple different things, and it's been a little tricky to manage. But I will definitely, you know, tweet about it on the BG Bros Twitter when that comes around.
All right. That'll do it for Matt Plugs, and that'll do it for our episode. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening.